Well, all right. Welcome back to Mormon Expression. And that was me channeling my best John Larson voice. I'm your host for tonight, Lindsay Park, from the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast, filling in for John, who is across the pond in England right now on a trip. But he will be with you next week, so you won't have to endure this very long. But sitting next to me, I am overcompensating for John's loss with an amazing panel. I have the fabulous, the famous Richard Dutcher. Can you say hello, Richard?
Hello.
Yes, we actually have a movie star, a movie producer, movie director, a Mormon film cinema extraordinaire in the studio. So hopefully that makes up for John not being here. And I also have the wonderful Thane Forbes back for another.
Thank you.
And Brian Whitney, can I call you church historian? What should I call you?
No.
No.
But Brian is fine.
Former church historian.
I just recently finished an internship with the LDS Church History Department, so I'm not an official payroll church historian.
You should know, though, that I did pick him up from the church history library today. So she did. He was sitting there like a little nerd in front of the
microphone. All
his
protestations to the negative.
Yes, so I brought this panel on, and we're going to be talking about a topic that's been talked about quite a bit, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. But the reason why I wanted to talk about it is for several reasons. First of all, I have an ancestor. I'm related to Dudley Lovett, who is listed as a clubber and a shooter on the Baker Fancher party. So that's our family's claim to fame. And his granddaughter was Juanita Brooks, so she's family as well. So it's a very personal interest to me, but I also feel like no one is really in the podcast scene. We've talked about the events, but they haven't really dug in deep and talked about some of the impact and the controversy surrounding it. So we're going to do that. But first, we're going to talk about Mormon news stories. And luckily for us, there has not been very much going on. But let's talk about some of the stories coming up. Some of the big stories in the Mormon newsroom right now are the Mormon hashtags. Have you guys heard about this?
Yes.
Mormon, you heard about this?
Yes. How terribly exciting.
It's so exciting. So Revelation now can be in a form of a hashtag. The Mormon newsroom put out a list of recommendations for hashtags. So they are recommending that if you're going to talk about the Mormon church, you can use their general hashtags. So there's hashtag Mormon, hashtag LDS, hashtag Jesus Christ and Christian. And then if you want to talk about anyone in the First Presidency, they all have a hashtag. So yeah, anything you guys want to say about hashtags?
Maybe a little bit late to the game. We're coming again. Maybe if I was going to sell the church, I wouldn't use Twitter, but I'm an old guy, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
Who hashtags outside of just being sarcastic?
Well, apparently a new apostle does, because that's also in our news. There is a Mormon apostle that has now joined Twitter. You can all follow M. Russell Ballard, because he is on there, baby. I'm looking at it right now. It's got his nice little headshot with Jesus. And according to the Desert News, or no, the Herald Extra, he had about 5,000 followers when the
So
started.
Is he actually doing it himself, or is he having a team? He's my least favorite apostle, so I'm just wondering if I tweet back, like, offensive things in the middle of the night, will he actually read them, or will it be...
I think as long as you put a hashtag in front of his name, then it should be good.
Awesome.
No, I don't know. What do you think?
If he has push notifications on his iPhone, then he'll be waking up at midnight when you're pushing that.
Finally,
stuff.
We don't need to line up in front of Temple Square anymore. We can just
exactly. This is right to the.
Yeah,
okay,
like
I'm liking
it.
This idea better now.
Yeah. Okay. I see how this is working. So that's some of the big news in social media for the church. There's also just a few things that have hit the radar. There's a lawsuit filed against the church. This made some news. You guys didn't know about this. I'd seen it on Reddit. And
yeah, this is the first I heard about it was today from you.
Yeah. I'm not making this up. There's a woman in Arizona that is claiming that she was sexually assaulted or abused by a missionary and impregnated by him, and that the bishop covered it up with hush money. I think that that's how it went. Allegedly. So that's happening in Arizona. It hasn't really made big news, though.
No, and not a lot. So I hesitate to say anything about it because you hear similar stories. You know, a lot of people will say, I told my bishop this thing in confidence and then found out that everybody knew. Or I told my bishop this really painful thing and he said, suck it up and, you know, go back to your husband or whatever. So I, you know, we hear similar stories and so I'm afraid that I've conflated this story with others.
Yeah, this is not the first time I've heard about it, too, but apparently a lot of people were excited about it on Reddit, like it was a big deal. I don't know. I don't know much about the legal system. We were talking about if it was a civil suit because the statute
of limitations. Well, lawsuit means civil.
So this had happened several years ago. She's grown now. So you can look that up. It happened in Arizona.
That reminds me of a great story. It may be a myth, but I remember as a missionary in Mexico arriving and people were, you know, the missionaries have all these stories that we tell one another. And one was of a new companionship going to an area that nobody had been there for about 3 years. Nobody exactly knew why. But when they were going around knocking on all the members' doors, they knocked on this very attractive single woman's door. And she came out and she goes, oh, I've missed you guys. We haven't seen you for a few years. And she goes, I just want to introduce you to my son, who's 3 years old. And, you know, we named him after his father. His name is Elder.
So, wow.
I have to work on the punchline there a little bit.
No, that's good. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard like similarly. With why is it always the mission stories or like these apocryphal type stories? Like this missionary made out with so and so and like snuck out to the movies and then got a girl pregnant and.
Oh well, that stuff happens. I mean, that's not apocryphal.
I don't think that's necessarily apocryphal.
I have yet to meet someone who has that happened to.
No, every missionary has that story with his companion.
If you got someone pregnant on your mission, call me. I would like to talk to you.
Not pregnant, but made out on your mission.
If you made out with someone, send me a message.
There you go.
Besides your companion.
No, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I want pictures. I want a sex tape.
So you're saying
I don't
believe that a 20, 21-year-old man would
is going to sneak out.
All the thousands of missionaries out there, that there's not one.
Don't shatter my vision of the Lord's stalwart servants, okay, you guys? Like, I see these young men walking around my neighborhood looking very hot. Oh, gosh.
Forlorn.
Okay, let's move on. This is just going in all kinds of terrible directions. Okay, so our other news story is Glenn Beck was speaking at Liberty University and invoked his Mormon faith. Did you guys hear about this?
Yeah.
Liberty University is like this famous anti-Mormon school, right? By Jerry Falwell?
Is it? I know that they're wildly evangelical. Because virtually every evangelical student that I know went to Liberty. So, you know, that's the place to go for evangelical Christians.
The rumor I heard is that they actually have a class debunking the Book of Mormon or something like that.
So. That surprises me not at all.
So that would be considered anti-Mormon, right?
Yes,
from
it would.
Evangelical, I don't know.
Yeah, it is quite curious that of all the places he could have gone, you know, I mean, I can't think of anything other than PCU that would have been worse, you know.
So. Well, he said he was quoted as saying, "I am Mormon and share your faith." And then he said, quote, "Days before Joseph Smith was martyred, he was taken out by the sheriff. They tried to tar and feather him several times. The last time they took him, they said, 'You owe $25.' He said, 'No, I don't owe a man anything.' They said, 'No, you stole a stove,' one of the most ridiculous charges I've ever heard. At that time, he reached into his pocket and pulled out his pocket watch," Beck continued, "displaying the relic that he said had belonged to Smith. He gave it to the sheriff and said, 'I owe no man nothing.' They let him go. They killed him, but on the warrant for his arrest, he wrote on the back of his warrant to his people, 'Put down your guns. No matter what happens, put down your guns. Put down your guns and trust in the Lord.'" End quote.
So Brother Beck needs to read some history because the tar and feather incident happened, what, 15 years,
He might not have been referring to that Missouri incident or Ohio incident. He might have been referring just to the constant threat.
Wait, are you saying that Glenn Beck needs to read history?
That's exactly what I'm
just
saying.
Just as Joseph Smith reached in and pulled out a watch, I think Glenn Beck reached into his ass and pulled out that story.
Yay, we have our first contribution from the swear jar without John here. Yay.
Yay.
Good. You guys are going to have to swear double time because John's not here dropping the F-bomb.
Hells yeah.
See, it's already starting.
All right.
And I think the last story that I had, let me make sure, is Real Beauty just covered the surge of breast augmentations in Utah. And if you're in the feminist circles, you might have seen this story. Just that Utah has the highest rate, I believe, of Google searches for breast augmentation. And
well, that's probably these guys.
that's not all me. That's not all me. So
that's
there's
true.
Some other people. No, but this
is
a story that
in a whole different way.
Yeah. This is a story that shows up every year or two. You know, somebody will do another survey about cosmetic surgery, and Utah's number one again.
Does this mean that Utah has the largest breasts in the nation? Is that
the
biggest boobs?
The biggest, yeah.
Is that like a thing? Like, has someone done a study on
well,
that?
Well, they should. Someone should do that.
Someone should
I
study
will say
that.
This. In my ward out in conservative Stansbury Park, there are quite a few women that, I mean, I served in the Young Women's Presidency with two, and in the ward at the time, there were five that I knew of, because it became a thing. Like, let's all go over and show each other the work that we paid for. So,
yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, to each their own, but it's a thing in Utah.
So the story is Utah has the biggest breasts in the nation.
We could say it that way, if you'd
Dateline,
like.
Dateline Utah.
The biggest aftermarket breasts.
Yeah,
aftermarket.
So, yeah, I think that's the news report. Do you guys have anything to add? Did I miss anything?
Anything else to add?
Well, you see, okay, so the reason that...
You're saying you want us to augment your news
story. The reason that we have so many hits on their websites, and Richard is right, it's the guys that are looking at breast augmentation because they get to see pictures of the samples. And if their wife looks at their history on their computers, they don't get busted for porn. Their wife thinks, oh, he wants
I'm
me to get a breast
for
job.
You, sweetheart.
Right, so...
We've just discovered the source of the entire...
No, do here. Not... If you're going to Google it, go for gold, okay? Just Google breast. Right? That'll bring it up.
Oh, I can think of some things that'll get you where you want to go first.
No!
Faster.
Brian Whitney, no! They're trying to teach me sexual terms that I do not need to know tonight.
We can bleep that out. We can bleep that out in post.
So, let's get into the somber podcast. Mountain Meadows. Like I said, it's been talked about. We did episode 46.
46 was, and I think the title was just Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Yeah, with Gene Sessions, so you can go back and listen to that a little bit. And like I said, this has been talked about before. The church has been kind of more open in the past few years about it. They've published a book, and it was not published through the church. It was, is it Oxford?
Oxford, yeah.
Oxford. And Richard Turley and...
Glenn Leonard and Ron Walker.
Yeah, they... And what was the book called again?
It was called Massacre at Mountain Meadows.
Yeah, okay.
That was 2008 or 2009.
That's recent.
Yeah. And then Richard Turley also published an Ensign article about the same, I think, 2009.
Have they done an essay, a church essay?
No.
One of my cohort found a list of all the essays that are intended to be published, and there was 12 or 13, and that's on the list, but it hasn't been published yet.
So it's coming. Okay. Yeah, I'll be interested to see what they say about that. There, as we're going to talk about tonight, a large part of the controversy surrounding this is how much responsibility the LDS Church has in this event. So we're going to talk about the events. We're going to talk about what happened. We're going to talk about the major players. I want to kind of open with the stories that we don't talk about. Now, as you'll see as we talk about it, there were survivors of this massacre. And one of them was said to be Rebecca Dunlap Evans. And the historian Will Bagley, who is famous for his research on this, he collected these stories. So I'm gonna read you a little bit about what Will collected from her story, and then we're going to kind of go into the chain of events and talk from there. So I'm going to read an excerpt from Mrs. Evans' story. She was 7 years old at the time of the massacre. And because of that, she escaped. And you'll see why they left people that were who they thought were 8 and over alive. She said that she left with her parents and she had her sisters there. And when the massacre began, she hid behind a sage bush. Two of her older sisters were killed right near her and were lying dead beside her. She heard her baby sister crying and ran to find her. She found her entwined in her mother's arms, but the mother was cold in death. This sister, whose name was Sarah, and who was about a year old at the time, had been shot through her right arm below the elbow by a large ball, breaking both bones and cutting her arm half off. Seizing her sister in her arms, Mrs. Evans rushed back to the sagebrush where she had been hiding. She remained here until she saw a white man who proved to be Jacob Hamlin. She went up to him and begged him to save her and her little sisters. She says that Hamlin was the only white man that she saw who belonged to the massacring party. She remembers distinctly that Hamlin was dressed in a suit of green jeans. After the massacre was over, she saw quite a number of white men washing the paint from their faces. So I would urge you guys to all go. I mean, she's got this whole long survivor story, and her little sister that survives ends up marrying one of the U.S. Army men that came back to rescue them years later. It's a kind of an incredible story. So I would urge you guys to talk about this. Go ahead.
But just from my understanding of the massacre, Jacob Hamlin was nowhere near. I mean, he was nowhere near the site.
Yeah, so I don't know if she's confusing. She might be confusing him for
John D. Lee.
Well, or for Oscar Hamlin. Oscar Hamlin was there. He was the 24-year-old, brother of Jacob.
Yeah, and I do know that as far as these survivor stories, you got to remember these children were super young when this happened, and it was a traumatic year after. They would not be, you know, they would be fostered by a lot of these people, including Jacob Hamlin. He took them in. He was one of the people that took these kids. So a lot of their survivor stories are questionable. You know, she says she distinctly remembers mm-hmm. Jacob Hamlin in green jeans. And so we're going to talk about this and how there's a lot of rumors surrounding this. There's a lot of fogginess, a lot of things that we don't know. But there are some things that we do know. So should we go ahead and talk about the major players first? Let's kind of start at the beginning.
Sure. So to my mind, the players themselves are quite interesting just because you keep seeing the same people showing up. I'm not sure how to start with this, so I'll just start from the top down. Obviously, a major player in the whole controversy and the whole story is Brigham Young. And I don't want to say very much about Brigham Young because there's so much speculation. In my opinion, most of the speculation is you know, unfounded about Brigham Young's role in this. Suffice to say, I think that he created a culture where there was animosity and distrust of the immigrants coming through. Every immigrant train had an agenda in you know, I think in the opinion of Young, and so he fostered this distrust and fear. But I think that's, you know, in my study, I think that's as far as it goes. However, he was, you know, his lieutenant in southern Utah was George A. Smith, and I think that...
Not confused with George Albert Smith. Right?
Yeah.
It's different.
So, you know...
This is George that St. George is named after, correct? That's right.
I didn't George know that.
Smith. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, hey, look how smart we're getting.
Yeah.
So anyway, George A. Smith was, and I shouldn't use the word lieutenant, I should say, you know, right-hand man or assistant or whatever, but, you know, he was the southern Utah leader, and so he was getting his marching orders, so to speak, from Brigham Young, and he had great animosity and, you know, distrust of all of these immigrant trains. The other, two big players are the, militia leaders. William Dame, was the colonel. He was based in Parowan, and then under him was Major Isaac C. Haight, and he was in Cedar City.
Well, and let's give some context. So Mountain Meadows was in 1857 when the massacre occurred. So the church had just been in the Salt Lake Valley for about 10 years.
That's correct, yeah.
And Brigham had sent a lot of the men, some men that he trusted, some that he kind of wanted to get rid of to southern Utah to settle down there. And you got to remember, they had been driven out. And of course, as they're leaving Nauvoo and Missouri and all of these places, these stories of the martyrdom are growing. It's cohesive. It's bringing the wagon trains together. It's helping them cross the plains. They're feeling very persecuted. They're going to come over to Utah and start their own country. They developed the Deseret Alphabet. They developed their own language. They developed their own trading money system. They were really going to separate themselves from the world. So outsiders were complete enemies, and they were very suspicious of anyone.
It's an interesting paradox because at the same time, Brigham was also trying to convince the railroad to come through Utah and thought that it was going to be a place of commerce, right? So while he's trying to create that environment of separatism, he's also drafting a constitution to try to apply for statehood and trying to get the railroad again to come through. So, yeah, there's an interesting paradox.
It's a very interesting paradox is the word, because Brigham Young had already applied for statehood, and they gave him the territory instead, and the territorial borders were not what he wanted. His territorial borders were basically from the Front Range to the Sierras, you know, the whole that whatever we call this Great Basin. But and, you know, they cut that down, and he didn't get any of Mexico, and he didn't get any of Oregon and Idaho and that. They just gave him this chunk here, and they made him territorial governor instead of state governor. And so even at that, he kept petitioning to, you know, for statehood and never could do it. And at the same time, he's so suspicious of everybody, and he wants to keep everybody out of the state. It doesn't make any sense. But as you say, everything about the Mormons was different. You know, you listed all those things, but you should add the polygamy. You know, I mean, that really separated them from people in the East.
And most of these big leaders, these big players you're talking about, were practicing the principle, plural. They had plural wives. They had moved their wives down there to southern Utah, which would have been a really, really hard way to live. I mean, the dirt is hard and dry and rocky, and they were just poor. I mean, they hadn't been to Salt Lake for very long and super, super poor.
Yeah, it is interesting because, I mean, as you say, they sent these people down on these missions just a couple of years. I think 1850 is when they started, or 51 is when they started sending these people south, you know, to do whatever it was that they were doing. And it seems to me like a lot of the things that they were sending them down south to do were a pretense. They were going to send them down there to establish wineries or to grow cotton or whatever. And you know, these are people that have obviously never been to southern Utah, that, you know, that think that's going to be Dixie. You know, they called it Dixie. Well, this has got nothing, you know, this shares nothing in common with Dixie.
And they also had, we had a lot of the Utes and the Paiutes in Utah at the time. And remember, the Paiutes were completely displaced from their homes, from the Utes, and from colonization of the whites. And there was a lot of Indian conflict going on. The Paiutes kind of really banded together with the Mormons because Brigham Young had kind of convinced them or sold them that, like, we are your friends and the U.S. government is your enemy, and it's our common enemy, right? And that's going to play into our story too.
So in 1845, just before the Saints left Nauvoo, Texas was annexed into the United States. Texas was another possible location that Brigham was thinking about settling, and Joseph had thought about settling there before it was annexed to the United States. But Brigham had maintained some relationship there as well. So part of, like, southern Utah was actually Texas people who were coming up north as well with their slaves. In 1852, Brigham permitted, actually 50, Brigham permitted slavery in the territory in order to appeal to the Southerners who were coming up, and a lot of them were cotton farmers. So cotton mission was opened up in southern Utah. We also had the iron mission, which is in Cedar City, which is going to end up being a primary focus of what we talk about with Mountain Meadows Massacre.
That's true. I forgot about the iron.
Yeah. Now, before we move on from the major players, you mentioned Isaac Haight. Now, I think it's important to mention, again, I'm not a historian. My interest in Mountain Meadows Massacre is, you know, purely cinematic. I've always thought this would make an absolutely powerful movie. So if there's anybody out there that wants to,
I've got a screenplay.
Throw in a few million. No, I won't.
No.
But if you've got $3 million, I'll take that.
And
we'll go out.
I'm working on
this movie. So my understanding was Isaac Haight was also the stake president of Cedar City. Is that
and
correct?
Both and mayor, yeah.
Yeah, and William Dame was also a stake president.
Okay, I think that's important to establish before we move on.
Yeah, it is important to establish that these guys were, you know, they were civil authorities and they were religious authorities at the same time, and military authorities, right? Right.
Yes, yes. They held all titles: mayor, militia leader,
Indian agent.
Indian agent.
A lot of these guys were agents for the government.
Yep. Those two not, but I think John D. Lee was an Indian agent, right?
John D. Lee was, and wasn't George A. Smith?
Jacob Hamblin was. But
Jacob Hamblin,
yeah.
Okay.
And he's someone we didn't mention.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I skipped over John D. Lee. I want to go back to John D. Lee because his story is interesting. He met and was, you know, an associate of Joseph Smith. And so he goes back to at least Nauvoo, I think only up back to Nauvoo. But, you know, he joined the church there and, you know, was an intimate associate of Joseph Smith's. Then the prophet is martyred and, he comes out with Brigham Young and he becomes, you know, an intimate associate of Brigham Young's as well.
He becomes his adopted son through the law of adoption.
Adopted son, right. Mm-hmm. In the endowment house, he's adopted and in fact, on occasion would sign his name as J.D.L. Young. You know, indicating that his name is Young, not Lee.
And that's so how the high priesthood worked, right? I mean, if you had the priesthood and you were a priesthood leader at that time, you were in charge. It gave you power over the land. You had special connections. These guys were getting sealed to each other in these sort of, I don't know, power alliances?
Kind of a heavenly network. It's like networking, you know, in heaven, you know, where...
Celestial LinkedIn. There you go.
Yeah,
I like it.
Do you have anything you want to say about
somebody? Go grab that domain name right now.
The function of it, because it's going to come in when we talk about the massacre. You're going to hear some religious language invoked, especially in John D. Lee's confession. He talks a lot about the priesthood being involved and some of the oaths that they took.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So the priesthood is definitely part of this.
I mean, I would reiterate this much. John D. Lee was fanatical about his religion and about his relationship with Joseph Smith and his relationship with Brigham Young. He was a little bit fanatical.
Even at the time, he was accused of being a fanatic. Yeah.
Yeah. And his contemporaries said that about him.
Okay. That's all you want to say with that? Do you want to?
About Lee, yeah.
Should we talk about the events now, the timeline?
Sure, just sure. I think that we can probably start maybe actually with the Fancher party leaving Arkansas for California. The other thing to that, and I'm sure a lot of people are aware of this. So in 1848, when gold was discovered in California, that created a massive rush to the West Coast for a lot of families from the Midwest and particularly from Missouri and Arkansas area. This was something that I, you know, obviously Brigham Young wouldn't have predicted this coming over to the Great Basin. His idea was to go out there where nobody else was, but this became a major thoroughfare pretty quickly for people that were heading to California and also to Oregon. Oregon was another big stopping point for a lot of people trying to get to the West and start a new life. So the Fancher, Baker, Mitchell, Dunlap, Camerons, these are all families that left their home in Arkansas for California. We were talking earlier that we think that the Bakers might have been from Missouri, but according to record, they actually left from Arkansas, so whether they went down to Arkansas first as a stopping point. But, you know, as you're going down along these journeys, you have to stop for provisions, and you have to refuel. So Utah became a pretty central hub for emigrants to stop for provisions, for resupplying, for feeding their animals, their herds, their livestock. And people would spend quite a bit of time in Utah before leaving through Nevada and California. So we'll start off with that. April of 1857 was when the Fancher party departed from Arkansas. A month after that, May 13th, is when Parley P. Pratt was murdered in Arkansas. Right. Murdered by the jealous ex-husband, Hector McLean. Spring of 1857. So again, very tied into this. You've got President Buchanan sending an army to Utah to investigate rumors of sedition. There were territorial judges that blew out of Utah claiming that there was all sorts of unruliness going on here, that we were planning a rebellion against the United States government. And
those rumors weren't completely unfounded.
Yeah, some of them weren't.
The judges and there were other government officials, but they basically abandoned their post in Utah because they were, you know, they were fearful. And, you know, there's stories of these guys, you know, going out to get milk and ending up in California. You know, they basically just walked away from their post in Utah. Although that was several years earlier. I don't think that's in 57.
Well, and it's not like you can, like, tweet the prophet like you can now,
yeah.
Apparently. You, like, if there, everyone is talking about the army is always coming. Like, there was this fear in children and women. And if their husband left for business, they were worried about the army. They just knew the army is always coming. And you can imagine without communication like we have now, you hear one story and it could be months before you get some updated information.
Well, and Buchanan and his generals had started the plan. As it turns out, it took them 8 months to get here. You know, they started the planning for this, I believe in December of 56 or January 57. But, you know, as I say, it took them forever to get here. And so the rumors proceeded by many months. And, you know, coincidentally at that time, Brigham Young was planning for this invasion, and putting up fortifications in Echo Canyon, for instance. So he was, you know, he was of the impression that the arrival of the army was imminent.
Yeah, so I do have something from John Turner on Brigham's response to that when he learned that there was an army that was sent here. Says that his rhetoric became angrier and more vengeful at that period, and he started resuming talk about political independence for Utah, saying, "I shall take it as a witness that God designs to cut the thread between us and the world." So from late July through mid-September, and this is of 1856, Young formulated his political and medical, his political and military strategy, which included reviving the Nauvoo Legion, right? And so every town and settlement, was responsible to have a militia ready at arms, for this impending invasion.
And my understanding, and I could be wrong, the real only organization that held those things together was this sort of religious priesthood, right? I mean, and it's not priesthood how we understand it today, but that's what tied them together. It's not like they had uniform instructions or weapons or training. It was just sort of your rank and file leaders that reports to their higher priesthood leader that reports to their higher priesthood leader.
Right? Yeah, you're called to be in the militia, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, and the government of God to them was a real form of government, right? So amid the rumors that army troops had intended to hang Brigham Young, he had said, without sacrifice or with or without a trial, Young made clear that unlike Joseph Smith, he would not sacrifice himself to save his people. So when they started these militias, their immediate objective was limited to just keeping the army from reaching the Mormon settlements. Their plans were mostly to slow the troops and advance the militia raids on supply trains and other forms of just harassment. And then if all else failed, then the Nauvoo Legion would begin resisting the army's descent into the Salt Lake Valley. And if the Nauvoo Legion failed to stop the expedition's advance, then Young planned to evacuate and burn Salt Lake City down and evacuate to a new location, which presumably was down in Mexico. All right. So this is kind of the scenario that the Fancher Party is walking into.
Walking into the middle of, mm-hmm. Right. And so the Fancher Party ends up being kind of a rehearsal for...
Now, we kind of jumped ahead, and we're assuming that everybody understands who the Fancher Party is and what it was. So do you want to give us a quick update on... I mean, these were families. These were just, middle-class American families.
So when I was talking about the gold rush and the rush to California to create new lives, these are groups that were doing that.
Fanchers in particular were rather well-to-do in Arkansas, relatively speaking, and rather experienced. Alexander Fancher, who was the head of the Fancher Party in 57, had already been to California at least twice, and there's speculation he'd already been to California three times. And so he was in the process of planting his family in California. And so, you know, as I say, he was rather experienced on the trail.
Sarah Frances Baker, one of the survivors. She was three at the time. I think it was her that said that it was the most wealthy wagon train to ever come across the plains. I don't know how substantiated that is, but was her claim.
It is substantiated. The contemporary reports say the same thing. They say, this party is remarkable because, you know, they were gentle folk. You know, they're educated and well-to-do and polite. And, you know, they didn't swear and they weren't ruffians. So, all the reports from non-Mormons say that these were, you know, remarkable people in the contrast to, you know, run-of-the-mill immigrant on their way to get rich in California.
And this was a party of about 137, 138 people, is that correct? At the time of the actual massacre,
under 150 anyway. So, recapping, we had Pauley P. Pratt's death, we have news of the U.S. Army coming to towards Utah, and we get this revival of the Nauvoo Legion, and we begin seeing this massive rhetoric from Brigham Young that's very anti-outsider, very anti-Gentile and anti-immigrant.
Anti-American.
And anti-American, exactly. Yeah, at the time. And,
oh. I was just wondering if, like, if Venture had so much experience coming out here and, like, everything else that was going on, is it possible that he had any ideas, like the leader of this group, that there was so much political unrest in Utah? Or that they were, you know, I mean, clearly he couldn't have known about Pauley Pratt's death when he left, because...
It was a month after he left, yeah.
But, you know, just the rumors of the army coming out.
So as I understand it, the first time that Alexander Fancher came to California was in 1850, and then the second time was in 1853. And as I said, there's speculation he may have come a third time, but it would have been after 1853. And so, you know, things were different in 53. 53 is before the runaway judges, and 53 was before two droughts. And, you know, 53 was a whole different time. And so possibly probably he didn't know, or if he had heard rumors, he didn't understand, you know, the severity of what's going on. And then another thing to keep in mind is that his destination seems to have been Los Angeles. And so that's why he's going through Salt Lake rather than taking the California road that goes through. But as soon as they got into Salt Lake, Brigham Young had made it clear and had preached over the pulpit saying that we were not to trade with the immigrants. And the phrase he used was not a kernel of grain should be sold to them. And he had – so Brigham Young had – what's described as an intelligence network. And so he had his spies out there making sure that nobody traded with the Fanchers. And so they weren't able to trade because, you know, if they did, then, you know, the elders would come and tattle and stop them. And there are reports mm-hmm. where the elders did, like, literally go and stop a sale of, a block of cheese or, you know, a bag of flour.
There was another report of a member who was beaten pretty badly for trading with immigrants during this time. So just getting back to the timeline then, so... July 1857, we get word, July 9th, we get word that the immigrants have arrived in Salt Lake City. I apologize, July 20th. July 9th, there was a newspaper article that came out of Alta, California, bragging about Pauley P. Pratt's death. So within 11 days, you get this party that's arriving in Salt Lake City. You have constant drilling of the Nauvoo Legion in their various areas. You've got this rhetoric.
Up and down the Wasatch Front.
Yeah. And then you have this strong anti-outsider rhetoric and anti-American rhetoric at the same time. July 23rd, 1857, Elias Smith wrote in his journal, Pauley P. Pratt was one of the apostles and was in Kansas at Fort Scott and Fort Smith for the purpose of enlightening the people on Mormonism. He unfortunately for himself was murdered by the heathen Gentiles. This immigrant train happened to be from the same section of the country in which Pratt was killed. The Mormons were so insulted and indignant over the death of the murder of Pratt that they wreaked untold vengeance on the poor immigrants. This is supposed to be the cause of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Now, we have a lot more information than that now, but this was, as you can see, at the time, this was the ongoing rumor that these people were from the same area that Pratt was just murdered in. And that was fueling hostility. Right.
Now, can we take a quick moment and talk about this murder of Pauley P. Pratt? Because that is important to...
I love this story. Because I'm a monster, but no, I love this story. It's a good story.
Please do. Yeah.
Well, I can only give you the broad strokes, but yeah, he was murdered by, you called him the ex-husband, but I'm not sure they were divorced.
No, they were not. So I'll start and you guys can
okay.
jump in with details. But Pauley was in Arkansas and he was doing missionary work amongst whatever else he was doing. And he had met this
amongst
woman.
Whatever else
he was doing. And what was her name? Emily? Somebody get that for me before I finish my story. Anyway, he had met her. She had been convinced by his preaching, and she wanted to join the church, but her husband wouldn't allow it. And Helen? Okay. So Helen
McLean,
right.
Isn't it Eleanor? Keep going.
See, I thought it was okay. We're gonna have to look this up. This is homework assignment for you folks at home looking now. Stop the podcast and go in and Google this. Anyway, she had been convinced to join the church, but her husband wouldn't allow it. Parley kept working on her, and eventually she absconded.
By working on her, I mean
yeah,
he was romancing.
Eleanor.
He was romancing.
Eleanor.
He
was bearing his testimony, Richard.
Correctly.
He was bearing his testimony.
He was burying his testimony.
See, so now stop. I'm trying to tell a story here. So anyway, at some point, you know, she absconded with him. And
well, I would just like to point out that she claims that her husband was abusive, severely abusive.
Yeah. And actually, she was living in California at the time, wasn't she?
When she went up to Utah. She had been back and forth because she had snuck out. And
he said she was crazy, right? So isn't that how it goes in breakups? It's always
The husband did?
Right.
That was
some humor.
I think you're right. I think that he did, actually. So I think he actually really did.
The children were sent away to her parents in, was it Mississippi or Arkansas?
And she went to California and then reconciled and came back and then left again with Parley, ended up marrying him without benefit of divorce.
She went in as a governess to their house.
Yeah, and then things got ugly.
Then got a different kind of job offer. And then he got called to the mission, and she went along with him to get her children.
Okay.
Right. Is that how it went?
Anyway,
we got there in the end.
Yeah.
Let's hurry up. So anyway, long story short, Parley's in Arkansas doing some stuff. This guy follows him all the way out.
Well, he's jailed.
And that's a fun story about his breakout of jail, too.
There's a great story.
There's a whole story, but we don't have time. We have so many stories to talk about.
This is not
the husband follows him out of town until they're alone. He finds him by a river and stabs him
multiple times, leaves him in a shallow ditch.
So basically, it's an angry, you know, he was angry.
As far as their divorce, she clearly left him. And I would argue that if you look at the times, a lot of people didn't get legal divorces during this time. They just left. That was pretty common. Andrew Jackson, president, he had a wife prior to his second wife who he was still technically married to.
I just think the important thing to note is that, you know, it wasn't just this. He wasn't martyred for the cause. It didn't have anything to do with it.
But that's how they looked at it. Absolutely.
That's all they heard, that he was murdered. Mm-hmm. And so.
Well, anytime an apostle dies, it had to be for the cause, for the, you know, right.
But if you're getting murdered for plural marriage, that's the cause, right? I mean, they're already being persecuted for their beliefs. He was. I believe he was. I'll double check because my memory is a little off tonight. But
once again, pause the podcast here.
Yeah.
Everybody go Google it.
Okay. So now we got the Parley B. Pratt story, at least the broad strokes. Let's keep going.
Mormon Expression is a listener-funded program. If you like what you hear, please visit us at MormonExpression.com and consider becoming a subscribing member. While you're there, let us know what you think about the show.
Okay. So we got the story in the California newspaper that was bragging about Pratt's death. We got the immigrants that show up July 20th, arriving in Salt Lake City. We have Elias Smith's journal talking about the Parley P. Pratt death. On July 24th, it says that our independence was declared as a free people by Brigham Young and his counselors. And the journal records all said amen. So we're, July 24th obviously was actually more celebrated than the 4th of July in Utah, at that time. And at that point, Brigham Young is declaring his independence from the United States.
And on that particular day, they had done July 24th celebration. It had been up in, somewhere in Cottonwood Canyon and, Big Cottonwood Canyon and, because it was up there, the whole city was up in Big Cottonwood Canyon, and the Fanchers kind of came into view, hove into view, as they say. They were still up in Summit County, but people came racing from downtown to where the Saints were celebrating the 24th of July at Big Cottonwood Canyon to say, oh my goodness, the immigrants are here, the immigrants are here. And so this is only a week before they got there, right? And, because they arrived, I'm remembering August 1st. So the scouts or whatever come down from Salt Lake City, meet up with the Saints, say, oh my goodness, the immigrants are coming. And Brigham Young uses this as, an opportunity to change the rhetoric a little bit and stir things up a little bit more, saying, oh, here come these people, you know, trying to take over our way of life and whatever.
Can I have to make a quick side trip here? I've always
as long as it's not about Parley P. Pratt.
We're not. It's not about Parley P. Pratt. It's about Brigham Young. Actually, it's like one of my I love history. Love Mormon history. Love always going to these sites and hearing things. But two experiences I had was one was going to the Lion House and going through that tour. And listening to the, complete ignorance of the sister missionary who was leading the tour and, completely sidestepping every question that had anything to do with polygamy or anything whatsoever. And, getting up on the top floor and just saying, oh, there are other rooms upstairs that were used as bedrooms. And, I'm always the jackass.
Technically correct.
Raising my hand and, causing the trouble. But my favorite story was in St. George when I went through the Brigham Young House in St. George. And we get to one room, which was like the dining area, and there was a big plate of Abraham Lincoln. It's like Abraham Lincoln's face on a plate, up on the wall. And I made a point. I said, well, this is really strange to me because, I know Brigham Young was, certainly no, he was not a great fan of the United States of America.
Or Abraham Lincoln.
And Abraham Lincoln. Anyway, they gave me a bunch of nonsense, and I eventually quieted down. But the point being was, the revisionism that goes through there where they're taking us through and I have the same reaction actually every, I live in Salt Lake City and every 4th of July or 24th of July, it's the 24th of July and the Mormons are all putting out American flags. And I'm like, what the hell are you people doing? Brigham Young would have, projectile vomited over this, it's like, he would raise the flag of Zion or of Deseret, but this revisionism where we as Mormons we see ourselves as so patriotic and then we take that back to the 1850s and the 1840s and it was certainly not the case.
Were our enemy.
Yeah, and for some reason people are hesitant to talk about that. I think it'd make a fascinating subject, just anti-Americanism within Mormonism. Because that would just terrify so many people to learn about that. But at the time, Brigham Young was talking about, they left the United States of America as a people so that they could practice their religion. They fled the United States.
They would have left to Mexico again had they been forced to.
And then, they're talking about, fighting the government who's coming. And, so I just, in this segue, I think it's important to understand the kind of, at the time, in 1857, in Utah, and I'm going to go into this a bit when we get to my little section, but, the general feeling was not, raise your hand and say the Pledge of Allegiance and sing the Star-Spangled Banner. That's not what the Mormons of Utah were thinking. The Mormons of Utah were, if anything, the United States of America was, if not an actual enemy, it was a potential, very, very, potential danger and an enemy. And there was that same kind of Cold War, like it was, in the United States with that same kind of fanatic fear, and paranoia that existed, among us in the United States, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The same thing was happening, this was the same kind of
feeling. In the 1850s.
Exactly. Yeah.
And more fuel on all the fire of just the potential for violence at this time. While Mormons were technically, not part of the Union, it wasn't an issue for them, Mormons leaned to the abolitionist side as a people generally, because they were mostly Yankees or Northern European immigrants. And on top of all this, this is exactly when Bleeding Kansas is going on. The whole country, Texas, there's a whole question about Texas, a nation, all this stuff. The entire country is on the verge of violence all the time, It was just a violent time. Mountain Meadows didn't happen in a vacuum. crap was going on everywhere, all over the nation.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, well, and yeah, speaking directly to what you're saying, this is out of the Turley, Leonard, and Walker book. In their preface, they remind us of that. They say that the period from 1830 to 1860 has been called the turbulent era. Right, and indeed it was. There was, as you mentioned, there was violence going all throughout the frontier area there, and you know, and the bleeding Kansas part. I mean, that was also involving Missouri, right? And yeah,
and religious fanaticism springing up. A lot of American religions break off, schisms being formulated. I mean, it's the perfect concoction
so
for
getting,
religious fanaticism.
Getting back to the anti-American rhetoric and the timeline, on July 26, so again 2 days later from the July 24th celebrations,
back in Salt Lake,
Brigham Young has a meeting with his apostles where they where quote we discussed our enemies. Right, August 1st, 1857, I took Eleanor Pratt's statement on the murder of Parley P. Pratt. This was Wilford Woodruff's diary. August 2nd, 1857. Brigham Young publicly discusses the possible secession of the Mormon theocracy from the United States and the establishment of an independent kingdom. That's from Brigham Young papers. August 3rd, George A. Smith leaves Salt Lake for the South, and the Fancher Party has arrived in the Great Salt Lake area. August 4th, Brigham Young appoints Jacob Hamblin as the president of the Southern Indian Mission and orders the Fancher Party to depart. All right. August 5th, Brigham Young declares martial law. The formal announcement was set out on September 15th. August 8th, George A. Smith arrives in Parowan. August 15th, Samuel Pitchfork reports that the Fancher Party was camped near Nephi. George A. Smith goes to Cedar City. August 16th, George A. Smith preaches twice at Cedar City, spends the night with John D. Lee, and Brigham Young says in a sermon, "I will say no more to the Indians, let them alone, but do as you please." And what is that? To use them up, and they will do it. So this is, again, giving permission to the Indians to raid the immigrants that are coming through. August 17th, a member of Duke's train stated that he passed through the Great Salt Lake City on August 17th, and he saw everywhere preparations for war. That the company was harassed by Indians all the way, that in southern Utah they hired Mormon guides and interpreters to the sum of $1,800, and then were robbed in the Muddy River of 375 heads of cattle.
Can we stop and talk about the Indians for a minute? Because it's a big subject. As the quote that you just quoted or paraphrased from Brigham Young says, utilize the Indians, use them to harass these settlers. Well, the Mormons had been utilizing the Utes and the Paiutes for years, probably 4 or 5 years, for exactly that. They'd suborning these raids and supporting these raids, and so everybody that came through, they would rustle cattle and they would rustle other things and steal whatever could be stolen and harass all of these people. And it was a minor economy that was happening in stealing from immigrants. And the Mormons were not only encouraging the attacks, but also supporting them by fencing the stolen goods when they were done. So they would send Indians out, and the Indians would rustle cattle and bring 100 head or whatever back, and then the Mormons would buy that cattle and with impunity, because the settlers can't hang around and do anything about it. They're feeling lucky to escape with their lives. So this had been going on for years, and it had gotten to the point where the immigrants knew what was up, and the immigrants had noticed that some of these Indians were white, awfully white. And I'm not talking about Zelf the white Lamanite here.
Just to clarify, Zelf had died before this.
A couple of years before.
Not many, apparently.
Not many,
his
apparently,
bones were still,
yes.
On the ground.
Yeah.
Well, and it was general.
Missouri.
I mean, it was general. It wasn't it? There was. It was called fleecing the Gentiles. It was, I mean, it was a general practice that was, the Mormons felt you know, justified in robbing or, you know, or in, you know, indirectly
robbing. The beast is the other phrase that we hear used.
And they would use the martyrdom of Joseph Smith as the excuse, you know, and of course of being driven out of their previous homes, you know, the Gentiles fleeced us, now we're going to fleece them.
I'm so glad that you brought up the vengeance for the martyrdom, because that does play a role into this whole thing as far as just setting up the overall tone. And I don't know when it was in 1845, but the oath of vengeance was added into the temple.
Right.
Right. 45?
I thought it was left.
I do want to, I'm going to give you a quote from, this is a quote from John Dealey's confession again, because I've got that in front of me. And he claims that Isaac V. Haight took him on the 7th of September. And again, you heard that John Dealey was spending the night with George A. Smith, and now Isaac Haight comes. They're kind of grooming him, according to John Dealey, to be involved in this. And they take him away. He takes his stuff. He leaves his wives. He takes a blanket. And they go into the old iron works and camp out for the night. And they're whispering in secrets. It's very secretive. And he says, quote, "The word and command of Isaac C. Haight were the law in Cedar City at that time. And to disobey his orders was certain death, be they right or wrong. No saint was permitted to question them. Their duty was obedience or death. When I met Haight, I asked him what he wanted with me. He said he wanted to have a long talk with me on a private particular business. We took some blankets and went over to the old ironworks and lay there that night so we could talk in private and safety. After we got there, Haight told me about the train of immigrants. He said, and I believed every word that he spoke, for I believed it was an impossible thing for one so high in the priesthood as he was to be guilty of falsehood, that the immigrants were a rough and abusive set of men, that they had, while traveling through Utah, been very abusive to all the Mormons they met, that they had insulted, outraged, and ravished many of the Mormon women, that the abuses heaped upon the people by the immigrants during their trip from Provo to Cedar City had been constant and shameful, that they burned fences and destroyed crops, that at many points on the road they had poisoned the water so that all the people and the stock that drank of their water became sick, and many had died from the effects of poison, that these vile Gentiles publicly proclaimed that they had the very pistol from which the prophet Joseph Smith was murdered and threatened to kill Brigham Young and all the apostles." So that became a big rumor in Cedar City that these guys were toting the gun that shot Joseph Smith.
The very gun.
So again, about just all the lines of pressure going on, because we were talking about how the Mormons sort of had this friendly, utilized the Indian relationship. Remember, at the exact same time, the Indian wars are going on. So the Union is fighting the Indians. So this is just another way that Brigham can do the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And also, generally, they didn't like the way the Union treated the Lamanites, because they were the Lamanites, of course. The Mormons had this other view. And I lost my other train of thought. But you see all of these multiple lines where, oh, again, the idea of vengeance. Because it wasn't just vengeance against the mobsters who killed Joseph. You know, there was this general cultural push, and they saw the Union as being at most, or at least, a tacit accomplice, you know. Therefore, all of America. And so they played every line they could, because, of course, the Union in the South, all this tension was building. They played on that tension. The Indian Wars, they played on that tension. There wasn't a space where Brigham Young didn't put tension. So, of course, all of these people put pressure straight back, creating the pressure that leads up to what's coming.
And I'm just going to nuance one word. Played up the tensions versus getting caught up in the tensions, right? Because I think that if we're going to take an empathetic approach anyway, which I think to some extent we should, then there's just as much getting caught up in the tensions that are going on as much as there is playing the tensions or manipulating the situation, right? It's happening both ways.
Well, let's keep moving into the actual massacre, because now we know that there's a whole environment.
Yep.
You know,
exactly. I'm still about a month before that, and there's some important key dates here, but we'll get through this here. So August 18th, George A. Smith arrives in Washington City. He preaches in the afternoon, and Dame, at the same time, is drilling the militia.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny when you read Bagley's book that when he's describing these same events, every time George A. Smith arrives in a new town, he finds the militia on the drill field.
Yeah. August 24th, Wolfred Woodruff hears Eleanor Pratt describe Parley's death. So again, we've got that reminder of Parley's death. August 25th, George A. Smith camps near Fancher's at Cora Creek. Jacob Hamblin suggests that they continue the trail and rest at Mountain Meadows next to his homestead. August 18th, the Fancher Party, August 28th, the Fancher Party camps at Indian Creek, which is today's Manderfield. Silas Smith has supper with the Fancher Party that night. Between August 25th...
This is Silas Smith, a cousin of Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Between August 25th and September 6th, state president slash mayor slash militia leader William Dame and Isaac Haight, the senior regional military leaders of the Mormon militia, begin holding meetings about how to implement Brigham's martial law. September 1st, Hamblin and some 12 Indian chiefs on September meet first with Brigham Young and then with his most trusted interpreter, which was Dimmick Huntington.
Huntington, yeah.
Yeah. Of Great Salt Lake, taking part in this powwow were Kanosh, the Mormon chief of the Pavants, Ammon, the half-brother of Walker. There was the Walker war incident. And so you had this tribal meeting gathering. And he told, this is Young, told the chiefs that he, quote, gave them all the cattle that had gone to California by the south route. Right. Actually, I'm sorry, that was the chiefs telling Brigham Young that. Let's see. We've got September 3rd. Jesse N. Smith reports that the Fancher Party is at Paragona. The train arrives later at Parowan and is kept outside the town wall. September 4th, the Fancher Party arrives at Cedar City and camps west of the town. Isaac Haight, second in command of the Nauvoo Legion South Brigade, tells John Lee that he planned to arm the Paiute Indians and send them after the immigrant party. Two chiefs meet with Haight and John Higbee and receive order to kill the Fancher Party and to take their property. September 5th, Rachel Lee records that John Lee headed south and camps with the Paiute War Party. The men were ordered by Haight and Higbee to participate in action against the immigrants and are told to report to a place in the hills near the ranch of Jacob Hamblin. The Fancher Party heads south towards Mountain Meadows. September 6th, Brigham Young in a sermon declares that the Almighty recognizes Mormon Utah as a free and independent people no longer bound by the laws of the United States. Fancher Party simultaneously arrives at Mountain Meadows. Cedar City High Council meeting votes to, quote, do in the immigrants, and then decides to send a message to Brigham Young asking for his orders.
And the quote that that I have here is that Lee warned again that if Brigham Young wanted the immigrant companies to pass unmolested, he must give Dame and Haight explicit instructions, quote, for if they are not ordered otherwise, they will use them up by the help of the Indians. And then, unquote. And then, so a note on the phrase, use them up, that means kill. You know, it's not a phrase that we use now, but at the time that meant use them up, and make them no more. So, what Lee is saying is that their expectation was that they needed explicit orders from Brigham Young not to kill or not to have the Indians kill these immigrants. So that's, you know, where we had gotten at this point, which is, you know, remarkable. And I to a great extent, that's why we're here, to understand how they got to this point. And obviously George A. Smith was a big part of this, you know, writing as he was a day or two ahead of the party all the way down to Cedar City and then meeting them on the way back up, or passing them on the way back up to Salt Lake City.
We're drawing closer to the actual, to the biggest day, but this is where the attacks begin. September 7th at dawn, the Fancher wagon train from Arkansas bound for California is attacked by Lee with about 60 white men and their allies. The immigrants began to draw their wagons near each other and chain the wheels one to another. September 10th, at daybreak, Indians attack the Fancher Party. One is killed and three wounded. They break off the attack and they drive off their cattle.
One Indian, that's what you're... One Indian and three are wounded.
Haight meets with Dame at 2 o'clock in the morning and returns to Cedar City with orders. The militia commanders, this is all on September 10th, the militia commanders ring the town bell in Cedar City, calling out trusted members of the Nauvoo Legion. Indians attack Duke's train at Beaver. At dawn, Haslam arrives at Young's office. He was the one that was carrying the message to receive the orders.
Let's back up. This was on August 7th, which was a Sunday?
This is September 6th? 10th.
Excuse me. He arrived in Salt Lake on September 10th. He had been dispatched on the 7th because the High Council had met in Cedar City, and they had said, well, you know, if we need explicit orders, then we better get explicit orders. And so they had sent Haslam back to Salt Lake City, which is a curious thing because they knew that it was at least 3 days back to Salt Lake City and 3 days back to from Salt Lake City back to Cedar. So, you know, in retrospect, it looks like this is just some sort of an affectation that they made an attempt to avoid this attack. But, you know, one wonders why they bothered to dispatch Haslam at all. Yeah. Plausible deniability.
Cover your ass, right?
I said affectation. That's a $10 word, right?
So Haslam leaves Young's office at 1 p.m. with the orders that Young gave. Garland Hurt learns that the immigrants on the southern route had got themselves into
And what supposedly were the orders that
we'll Young get
gave?
There. We'll get there, Richard. This is suspense.
Oh, okay.
Cuz we don't know how this ends up.
Exactly. I was so surprised at the ending of Titanic. It went down. Okay, so Garland Hurt learns of the immigrants on the southern route had got themselves into very serious difficulty with the Paiutes. The Nauvoo Legion, did I mispronounce their name? I don't know. The Nauvoo Legion leaves Cedar City and arrives at Mountain Meadows at about 10 p.m., and militia leaders there hold a council. 7 a.m., Haslam arrives at Brigham Young's office with Haight's letter. Okay, so we have two conflicting reports on when he got there, and then left at 1 p.m. Young, according to the published Mormon reports, sent a message back to let the Indians do as they please, but for as the Mormon participants in the siege, if they will leave Utah, then let them go in peace.
You call that suspense?
That was suspense. Drama.
That was like, hey, 30 seconds. You know, 30 seconds.
So I'm not a screenplay writer.
He had you in the palm of his hand for 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't just answer the question.
This is the internet. People have a very short attention span. At noon, Mountain Meadows, White, Stewart, Arthur, Wilden, Hopkins, and Tate arrive. These were militiamen. About noon, several men arrive from Cedar City. They move camp 400 yards. Mormons begin to take pot shots at the immigrants. The immigrants chain their wagons together. 1 p.m., Haslam departs Brigham Young's office, and the main militia party under Higbee leaves Cedar City. In the afternoon, Lee reconnoiters camp and is detected. Immigrants.
And why is that important?
I don't know why that's important.
Because he's white.
He's white. They're claiming that they're Indians at the time, and now all of a sudden the immigrants see this white guy leaving, and they're like, oh crap, they've seen us.
Yeah, the immigrants set out two little boys, actually, is what it says here. And Lee persuaded the Indians not to kill the boys, he said at that point. So it's interesting. Stays on the west side for 2 hours. Okay, September 11th. Should I just do a summary, or should we break this down by minute to minute?
Well, we gotta kind of push it along because we're getting on.
Well,
so we gotta.
Yeah, I mean, I think we know how this ends. So I want to get.
So the wagon train gave up their guns, right? This was how this
the
went
deal,
down.
The deal that was proposed
the deal.
To them.
So the Mormon leaders they devised a plan to end the standoff by carrying a white flag. The Mormons met with the members of the Fancher Party and planned the immigrants' safe passage back to Cedar City as a way.
Let me just interrupt just a second, just to set it up a little bit. I mean, we've got this, you know, wagons in a circle. These, you know, 138 people who are in there, you know, scared shitless because, you know, first they think they've got an Indian attack, and then they realize that white people are involved too, that the Mormons are involved too. And so here they are, and then the Mormons, you know, we've got the Mormons and the Indians, and we haven't gone much into the conflicts that are going on between them at the time, because the Indians are like, you know, at the same time, they're like, hey, you know, you said we'd get this stuff, it'd be easy, and three of our guys are, you know, we're...
And these people are shooting back.
Yeah, they're shooting back.
That wasn't part of the deal.
And, in fact, we can get into some of that later about, you know, how much the Indians actually had to do with the actual, you know, massacre. itself. But at the point we're getting to now, you know, we've got these people that have been under siege for a good period of time. How many days now? They've been under
siege.
3 or 4. Yeah, 4 days. And, you know, trying to, you know, do they trust the Mormons? And, you know, the Mormons are sending people in as if these guys are, you know, somehow, you know, trying to, you know, negotiate peace between the Indians and the party, when in reality, you know, it was all just, you know, it was all just horseshit. It was these guys, you know, they're pretending to be on their side.
Right. And that's exactly what they said is, we're going to negotiate a peaceful settlement with the Indians on your behalf.
Right.
You know, and all you have to do is lay down your guns.
Right. And so this has been 4 days, you know, and every, you know, gunfire and hiding and, you know, and we have.
Right. And, you know, no water for the immigrants.
And, yeah. We have like, if our information is correct here, we have about, you know, 50 women and, you know, almost as many children and about 40 men, you know. So this is a, you know, if you try to get into the heads of these people who are there, they're under siege. I mean, people are shooting at them and they're in unfamiliar territory. And, you know, and then we've got the Mormons sending in emissaries trying to, you know, so-called right. make the peace. And that's where we get to
right.
the point
even
where
a bad peace is starting to look pretty good right now.
And so who is it actually that goes in to give the conditions of surrender?
John D. Lee claims he's the emissary. And there's some rumors at the time that they sent out a girl in a white dress, and he says that never happened.
No, it was actually a boy. And I actually did find his information. He was 13 years old who carried the white flag. And this is significant because in the appendix of the Walker Turley Leonard massacre at Mountain Meadows, it lists that boy as well, but it lists him as a 33-year-old man. They got his age wrong in there. And I don't know if that was just a misprint, if they just made a mistake, but I actually found his death record and he was 13 years old.
So he was a cross-dresser at 13.
He was a cross-dresser. I think it's significant though that they sent in a young child with a white flag. Right, that lead.
Was
that
he in a dress?
No, John D. Lee says that those were rumors.
Story. I was totally
he said, no, there was no white dress, but those were rumors.
I like your story better though.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So the wagon party is split up, is divided into two. So the Fancher party agrees to the terms reluctantly, but they agree to go ahead and follow John D. Lee and the Mormon brigade out, thinking that it was going to keep them safe from further attacks.
And tell us what the terms are. This is when my movie maker mind going for
tell
it.
Tell us, set it up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the terms are, you know, separation of, you know.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
You
oh,
know,
okay.
I mean, in addition to surrendering, you know, if they give up their guns, then they'll be led safely, you know, yeah. through, you know, so that the Indians will not molest them. They'll be led to safety. So give up all your guns, give up all your weapons, and we, the Mormons, will help you, you know, so that we'll
protect you from the Indians.
From the Indians.
Yeah.
And we'll
so
take you
in
to
order
safety.
To protect you, we're going to put a soldier on every one of you, you know, as a bodyguard. And we're going to march you out under the protection of the brigade, and then the women and children are following along behind in wagons.
Right.
They actually
and
send
am
them.
I missing anything?
They send them ahead. They actually send the women ahead, and they put the wounded at the very end. So there's
okay,
still
I got
there's some
backwards.
Wounded in the Baker Fancher party, and they put them in the wagons at the end.
So can you imagine making that decision? You know, it's like to trust these. You know, here's the Mormon priesthood in here telling them how it's going to go down, and. I mean, that saying, okay, I mean, putting themselves completely 100% at mercy, you know, and trusting the Mormon leaders.
And I need to say that you were right about some of the children are at the end. So any children under the age of 8. Now, this is an important part to me. We always talk about under the age of 8, innocent blood. But when John D. Lee and several others talk about this, they talk about children who couldn't talk, which I think is very important.
And would unlikely remember the events.
And would unlikely, which I think is very cruel. But it's later, it's really couched as, you know, 8 and under, this age of innocent blood not being shed. So children over the age of 8, and of course they don't know these exact ages, this is going to come back to get them later on, and women line up first. Then you have the men, then you have the wounded and the children in wagons in the back, under the age of 8.
So the men are marched off to the side in a single file, each with a guard next to them. And then
an armed guard.
An armed guard, yep. And then at some point, Major John Higbee shouted the order, "Do your duty." And at which point, each officer turned to the person next to him and opened fire.
But shortly before that happens, they start to hear the screams of the women and children. Now, they had purposely sent the Indians to hide in the bushes to kill the women and children. And Indians, I mean, not to get too graphic, were really good at hatcheting women and scalping them. And I was reading about rape and violence, and it said that Indians didn't usually rape, but they were really good at hatcheting women, usually the prettiest women. So this was kind of like their thing. And John Dealey would know that. He actually says in his account that, you know, he was crying and he said, I don't want to kill innocent blood. And they said, well, you're not going to kill innocent blood. These guys are all criminals. They're all wicked. We're going to keep the innocent ones, but we'll have the Indians kill the women and children just to be sure.
Yeah. And a quarter of a mile away, John Dealey led the wagons until they reach a point where Nephi Johnson ordered the slaughter of the women and children.
And the wounded, they start hearing, but the problem is they give the sign and it's not instant, right? Chaos ensues.
Yeah. Yeah. It said, the quote was hideous demon-like yells.
Yeah. So just envision this. You've got these separated groups all, walking in a line. I've been to the site. I visited a couple of years ago. I went to the actual site, and walked the ground and got a good sense of what it was like and, the mini ravines and things that are there. But, having these, you've got the men, you've got the women and children, you've got the wounded and the very young children. And then, to start hearing the chaos of the Indians attacking the women and the children. And then, literally these were, your deacons and maybe not your deacons, but priests,
and
your elders walking along next to their person. And when they got the order, having to, turn with their guns and put it directly, this is point blank, putting it directly against the head of the person that they're supposedly guarding and just blowing their brains out, So you've got the hatcheting of these women and children, and you've got this, point blank, just executions going on, en masse. 100 and how many did we say there were?
120, and over within a few minutes.
Yeah, so just this murder on a huge scale all happening all at once. And absolutely horrifying.
Sarah Baker, who was 3 at the time, later said, "It's funny how you will recall unimportant details after so many years. She remembers the black borders on the bright blankets in the wagon she was placed in. She remembers heard her father tell her mother, get up and put the children in the wagon, and that's the last time she hears her voice. And her memory of the event is the black border of the blanket, which I think is interesting. And years later, these children would go on to remember dresses that their parents wore or clothes that their attackers wore. Really interesting memories like that.
So that leads us up to the event, and I'm sure that you want to talk about the aftermath of it at some point, but did you want to move on to something else before then? Or
no, I just...
Richard's section.
Yeah, let's...
Well, just to wrap up, the story is suddenly there were 120 dead bodies, and a lot of them were just left there. The small children were taken and, taken by the Mormons and eventually adopted into families. And so these were children that were raised by, the murderers of their families.
For at least a year.
For about a year until the federal officers came in and returned a lot of them to their family members.
So Jacob Hamlin took him. His home is close to the site, the kill site. And he takes these children. A lot of them are completely traumatized. Some are wounded. Like I said, I read at the very beginning of the podcast, a little baby, she has a ball in her arm. And they're kind of, in the next few weeks, they're broken up and shipped to these houses. John D. Lee would take one in, and they remember this little boy wouldn't talk for a long time. And they essentially live with their parents' murderers for a year until the army comes in. But that's a whole other story.
Now some stayed longer. I'm almost positive of that.
Well, they had a hard time tracking it down, and of course there is a lot of complications with getting that down. And of course, a year later when the army comes, they're horrified. They erect a monument and things like that.
Well, bury the bodies.
And within a year, a lot of these people left Cedar City. Cedar City effectively shut down after this. So they left, and so it was hard to track a lot of these families down.
Although one of the survivors remembers being placed with a family, and she remembers some Mormon girl saying, let's go out to the site. So she follows them out there, and there's clothes, still hanging on the bushes and things like that. Although they did strip the bodies, they did not clean it up very good. It's shallow.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that the Mormons and the Indians, went in and took everything that they could take, all the anything of value off the bodies.
Stripped them naked, left their bodies there, covered them with
some even turning it in for tithing.
Yeah, the bodies were not buried. There was no, you know, the bodies were just left, you know, left in the...
Yeah, the little girl remembers seeing pieces of hair in the bushes, which I think is gruesome.
Yeah, I read that. That was awful little detail. So that's where we are. And, of course, naturally, a lot of people... this is why a lot of people are horrified, you know, by the Mountain Meadows Massacre. A lot of people don't want to, if you want to really kill a dinner party, you know, in an LDS house, just bring up the Mountain Meadows Massacre and start talking about it.
Although everybody will have somebody that was part of the Mountain Meadows Massacre in their family line if they're from Utah.
I really do. Yeah. It's legit.
No, I'm not saying, I'm saying literally everybody I've spoken to says, oh yeah, one of my relatives was there.
Quick tangent. I was really talking to a friend of mine who's a Levitt, and we got talking about this because I was reviewing the facts in my mind, and she says, oh, I have family that was involved in that. And so we start talking about family, and I mention my family that's from Southern Utah, and I go, I don't think they were involved in this. And she goes, what was his name? And it turns out we're cousins. So everybody's a cousin in Utah. And this is, you know, one of my best friends. And now I'm going to introduce her always as my cousin.
All roads lead to Mountain Meadows.
Yeah. Well, and it's important too that as soon as this happened, I mean, there was just a lockdown. I mean, the saints were ordered not to talk about it. They wouldn't even talk about it amongst themselves, you know. So as the years went by, I mean, this was just an ugly, ugly thing that happened, and nobody wanted to talk about it, not to the outsiders, not to themselves. They just wanted to forget about it, put it in the past.
Juanita Brooks wrote this about that. She said, in the essentials, all the different accounts agree. She said, the points of difference come in placing the responsibility for giving the execution orders, obviously. For many years, it was all so secret, just like you said. The whispered stories told and retold, modified to suit the whim and imagination of the narrator. Rape added to murder, detail supplied so generously that it had been difficult to sift out the facts.
Right, so, and John Dooley would marry a young bride from England only 3 months later and bring her from Salt Lake City to his family ranch. And this little boy is living in their home now. And she's just, you know, this teenager, like, oh, I found my polygamous husband, yay. And she comes and she's hearing some rumors. And anytime it's brought up, everyone's like, don't talk about it, that's rumors. You're going to hear some awful stuff about your husband, but it's just not true. So just ignore that. And there's even rumors later, I think in the fictional account by Judith Freeman, who writes about these wives, she talks about a story of this woman be given a dress that stains, has red stains on it, that is recognized at a picnic later. And that's kind of fictionalized, but there are actually rumors that those things happened, that their stuff was circulated. She recalls coming to the home and seeing shoes lined up, lots of shoes, at John Dooley's home.
So nobody wanted to take responsibility for this, right?
Right.
Sadly for John D. Lee, he was okay with his involvement, it seems, and he talked about it a lot. Never really denied his involvement in it, which later on led to him becoming kind of scapegoated for this, right? Because he was open about his involvement.
He forges a fake report that he claims Brigham ordered him as an Indian agent to say, hey, the Indians killed it. He says Brigham Young signs off on this. He reports it to Brigham, and Brigham's like, yeah, let's never speak of this again. I'll sign off on that, blame it on the Indians.
One thing I've noticed when I do talk to people about this, if they do have family members that were involved, they always seem to preface it with it, but I don't think they were one of the shooters.
Right.
So that makes it better.
They were there. They were having a picnic.
Well, and actually you find John D. Lee's descendants who are very, you know, John D. Lee was right in the middle of the whole thing. And there's so many ways to look at his involvement. Like, was he a good guy? He just caught in a bad place? Was he a bad guy? I mean, did he become a bad guy? Is he responsible for this attack? And you find his descendants are just violently, you know, defensive of his name.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of everybody's a cousin, I know one of his descendants, and they are that. So I had a quote about John D. Lee, and you know, he's described as being both generous and ruthless, and I described him previously as being kind of a nut job in his devotion to Brigham Young. But the people that had described him had said, he was the kind of man that would split his last biscuit with a traveler and then kill him if Brigham Young said so.
That's perfect.
So,
That's perfect.
Generous and ruthless at the same time.
Well, and the long story short with that is John Dealey is the only man ever prosecuted for this. He is killed by firing squad later on.
Right.
But let's talk about the controversy.
Okay, yeah, I'm fascinated by this because the Mountain Meadows Massacre is one of the reasons it's a killer at dinner parties is because Mountain Meadows Massacre is a huge can of worms. I mean, it's huge. You open this up and all these little worms start coming out and you don't want to acknowledge or talk about any of these. But I do. So yeah, I just wanted to bring up a few of these because, you know, here we're talking about, you know, we've gone through the horror of this experience of all these, we've talked about, you know, if accounts are correct, then we've got, that's not my bottle, by the way. I just want to point that out. Mine's safely up here on the table. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, the deception that was involved, the lying, the murdering, the stealing, and all of these by, you know, supposed good members of the LDS Church in 1857. So, you know, this brings up, how did this happen? And that's where the worms start crawling out, you know? So it's like, you know, a big thing is how involved was Brigham Young in this, what ultimately is history has kind of laid all its cards on the table, at least as many as we can find and read. You know, this was a mass murder. This was an absolute mass murder by Mormons, you know, in the Cedar City, St. George area. And how did this happen? And we go back to look at it, and we look at it, you know, in the priest, you know, priesthood authority having men like Isaac Haight and Dame, who were priesthood authorities, and basically, to me, these are the bad guys. These are the guys. When I, you know, look back on the story, I think, you know, Isaac Haight is just a son of a bitch. You know, it's like he's standing off. He's not wanting to get his own hands bloody, but he's willing to go and, you know, order, you know, using his priesthood authority to order the execution of these other people. So we've got, so where did this, you know, so did it, I mean, that's one of the big questions, you know, how much did Brigham Young have to do with it? And my question is how much does that really matter? Because we've already gone through, and talked about, you know, Brian's talked about how, you know, the culture at the time, you know, all this anger, all this anti-immigrant, you know, and this fervor that was built up, which was fueled primarily by Brigham Young. And so was he directly responsible, as in did he actually order them take out this train, you know, do it, take these guys out? Or was he indirectly responsible just by saying, by fueling this, you know, this hatred and this violence?
I think he's cryptically responsible because, you know, he made his wishes known. He told several people on several occasions, it's, you know, these people need to be used up. And, you know, he dispatched George Smith to whip up, you know, and deliver that message a day, literally a day ahead. And, you know, he made better time because he was in a carriage, but, you know, he dispatched George Smith to give his orders to William Dame, and William Dame gave his orders to Isaac Haight. So, you know, you can't, you know, even though we don't have written orders, you can't help but think that this was Brigham Young and Brigham Young's intent.
Right.
So John Turner, in his biography of Brigham Young, wrote this, and I agree with John Turner's take on this. He says, there's no satisfactory evidence that Young ordered the massacre. At the same time, Young bears significant responsibility for what took place at Mountain Meadows. A more prudent and responsible leader would have calmed rather than inflamed anti-Gentile sentiment and restrained rather than encouraged Indian attacks on American civilians. The several acts of violence that had occurred all throughout the previous winter, and there's numerous that he mentions, all suggested how easily violent rhetoric and incautious decisions could have unexpected and deadly consequences. During the early stages of the Utah War, Brigham Young fomented the hatred and anxiety that made it conceivable for Mormons in southern Utah to slaughter men, women, and children.
Right, and the point that I want to make, you know, getting back to this one particular worm crawling out of the can is, you know, whether it was Brigham Young or not, whether it fell on Isaac Haight or whether it fell on anybody else, it did fall on priesthood authority. It fell on, you know, okay, if it wasn't the prophet, then it was the stake presidents, you
and
know, that
were responsible.
And they all
took blood oaths on the spot afterwards, allegedly.
Right.
That if they told, they would be killed by the rest of the priesthood.
Right. So you understand why this isn't taught in Sunday school and primary. in the LDS Church, because it opens up this big question. I mean, here we have a situation, an actual real life, you know, documented situation where a couple of stake presidents ordered the actual, you know, the ordered actual murder. You know, they ordered their,
and participated in.
The priesthood, you know, the priesthood holders under their responsibility actually ordered them, you know, to commit murder. And this, of course, goes violently, you know, goes against this whole Mormon understanding that we have of, you know, do what your leaders want you to do, because they're not going to lead you astray. And you can see the kind of dilemma that your average elder, I mean, here's a guy who's like, you know, he likes to drink a beer now and then, and here he is out there, and they call him out there, and, you know, he goes off in the wilderness because they need him to go there, and suddenly they're putting a gun in his hand and saying, you're going to shoot this guy in the head, you know, as soon as we give you the order, you're going to shoot him in the head. So, what was that?
No.
So,
Lindsay.
So anyway, so that's it, you know, so it calls into question, you know, the priesthood, you know, priesthood authority, and obedience, this, you know, this culture of obedience that's prevalent in the LDS Church. The other thing, it starts to open up, you know, how did this happen? We started talking about the rhetoric, and we mentioned briefly the temple oaths, you know, the oaths of vengeance that were sworn in the temple. This is something else, you know, the average member of the church hears about, and they think, oh, I never heard about this. You know, it's like that was part of the temple endowment, was to swear an oath to avenge the blood of, if the opportunity arose, to avenge the blood of Joseph and Hiram. And
I think it's that's pertinent, because even if they didn't think they were avenging the blood of the prophets, it shows you the state of mind that they were in.
Right.
That you know, the us against them, the paranoia, the animosity with Americans was such that this is something that's on the table. Right.
Right.
You know, vengeful murder is
right. I mean, you're basically swearing in a temple ceremony that if you have the opportunity and you're in a room with somebody that you know was part of the martyrdom, that you're going to actually take their lives. I mean, that's pretty heavy stuff. And I think that particular worm, you know, goes back to, I mean, who put that in there? Obviously, that was Brigham Young that put that as part of the endowment. So
what I'm most interested in, though, is how, so you've got the group leaders of this, clearly, there's this sense of fear, paranoia, this heightened anxiety, this cultural rhetoric going on. What I'm really curious about is the rest of the people, right? So we have documented 65 people that were present, that were there, that were part of this militia group. What about the rank and file, right? And what's their story? How do they go from living in Cedar City and Parowan as farmers, ranchers, and iron workers, to becoming cold-blooded killers?
Right, saying their prayers and doing the best they can, and suddenly they're...
Exactly.
Well, aren't there accounts of some men dropping down their weapons in disgust? I mean, of course, they all claim that they were the ones that did that.
I'm sure everybody claims that. So, and yeah, there are some accounts of that, but there's also a lot of ambiguities, like everything.
Okay,
as
everybody's
to,
avoiding blame and
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
casting it all on other people.
But if I could move into that segment of this group, because I think that is...
Well, let me go into... I think that's fascinating, too, and I don't want to leave that. But, you know, I just want to mention a couple other little worms before we leave the can.
Sure.
And, you know, one of them brings up the, you know, this fact that even after the murders, the acquiring of the wealth, you know, there's something that's just, you know, makes it seem, was this simply robbery? You know, was it murder for robbery's sake? You know, ultimately, was that what it was? And then it brings up also, you know, bringing the Parley P. Pratt murder into the story, which it absolutely was a part of the story. I mean, that, you know, that raises a whole lot of questions about Parley P. Pratt's activities as an apostle in Arkansas. And, I mean, his activities as an apostle, you know, in any way. So, I mean, it brings polygamy into the subject. It brings, you know, it brings adultery into the subject. It just, you know, it's just, this Mountain Meadows Massacre is just a basic, you know, cesspool of trouble.
It's a mess.
And we understand why now the church, and church members have so, you know, so rigorously tried to avoid the subject, and they can't anymore. You know, the history's caught up, and it's fascinating history, and it's going to make a hell of a movie.
Get on that, would you?
And yeah, and actually that's part of the thing that, as a dramatist, that's something that fascinates me more, is like, what, you know, that is where the story is. There was a terrible movie made a few years ago. It was called September Dawn, and it was it was awful. It was made by people that knew nothing about Mormonism and even less about cinema. about movies, and
which is the greater sin, yes.
And but the real story here for me is it's that it's not necessarily. I mean, maybe John D. Lee, certainly not Isaac Hayes or anything. It's your just average elder from Cedar City who's out, you know, farming and trying to take care of his family. And he believes in the Book of Mormon, and he's raising his family as the prophets have told him. And suddenly he's stuck. He's out in the middle of nowhere with a gun in his hand and told that he has to, you know, murder someone. And this is what God wants. And not only that, but you know, the struggle that that person would have to go through to actually do that. But then once it's done, how do you live with that? You know, once it's done, once you actually. And that's what fascinates me about this story. And it's not one person. It's, you know, so many people. It's 50, 60 people.
So the people that were involved, we have cataloged who they were. We have given some bibliographic information on them. There's appendixes in the Massacre at Mountain Meadows that discusses them, mostly their military involvement, not necessarily their personal family backgrounds, but you can still find that stuff relatively easily. For the past couple of days, I've been reading through their personal biographies, and it's been heartbreaking, to be quite frank, to read from some of the rank and file. And I just want to give two quick biography summarizations, if I can. One is Alexander H. Loveridge. He was 29 years old at the time of the massacre. He was born in Ontario County, New York. He converted to Mormonism along with his mother in 1841. Joined the Saints in Nauvoo. He was part of the Nauvoo expulsion, and in 1846 departed Nauvoo and remained around Council Bluffs until 1850, then continued to Utah, settling in Lehi, where he began building cabins, digging irrigation ditches, and planting crops. He played some part in the Walker War of 1853. We're not sure exactly what. He settled in Cedar City in 1854, sharing a dugout with another family, and then began working with a team of horses and wagons at the Deseret Iron Company. He began herding livestock in 1856. He hauled coal, and then he was enlisted into the militia. All right. He was involved in Mountain Meadows Massacre as a shooter. After the massacre was over, he returned to Lehi, where he and his family would remain for the rest of their lives. So they left Cedar City and went back to Lehi. He helped build the first meeting house in Lehi, and ultimately he worked on the Salt Lake Temple. Daniel S. McFarland.
Wait a minute, that was it?
That I told you, a synopsis.
I thought you were going to tell us, like, I thought he was going to end with, like, blowing his brains out or something.
No. You see, and that's the startling thing, is a lot of people, they had to move on. And, you know, so for a lot of people...
But you said it was heartbreaking. Is heartbreaking why? Just because you're seeing this is an average, this is a normal
exactly.
guy?
Exactly. What I'm seeing as heartbreaking isn't necessarily the aftermath that happened to these individuals, other than the fact that hardly any of them stayed behind, right, and stayed in Cedar City. So obviously they were affected enough to move, plus the ironworks at Cedar City pretty much went defunct after this. But what's heartbreaking is just when you go through these biographies one after another, you begin to see this pattern of the type of person. Right, that was, and this is the second.
Believers. They were hard workers and true believers.
Yeah, and a lot of them were immigrants, and this next one is an immigrant. So keep in mind that the Perpetual Education Fund had started in immigration. Confusion. The Perpetual Emigration Fund had started in 1852. Right. So a lot of the people that were coming into the area were immigrants from Scotland and England. In fact, Cedar City was well known for its heavy English ancestry, and the people that were there went there because of this sense of English identity that was there. Plus, it was a great place to find work. We were expanding the rail line from Salt Lake City down at the time, so they were building a steam engine out of Cedar City. This was the silver mines, or the silver mines, but the main iron area, right? The iron mission. So work was to be found here. Plus, this cultural identity. All right. So the next one is Daniel S. McFarland, 20 years old at the time of the massacre. He was born in the Scottish Highlands in 1837. His family converted to Mormonism in 1842. His father died a year after his family converted to Mormonism. He journeyed to Utah in 1852 under the Perpetual Emigration Fund and traveled under the direction of Isaac Haight. Once they arrived in Utah, they settled in Cedar City in the, at that time, newly founded Iron Mission. Daniel's mother became a plural wife of Isaac Hayes. Daniel became a member of the Cedar City Dramatic Association. He acted in tragedies and farces. He joined the Scots and the Welsh in a choir. He married there. He married one of the daughters of Isaac and Anne Eliza Haight. He enlisted in the militia and was part of the military council of September 10th. He was on horseback on September 11th, carrying orders back and forth between John D. Lee and John Higbee. And McFarlane, another one of the guards, headed a cluster of women and children on horseback. And as the firing commenced, Daniel was among two or three guards that kept the emigrants corralled in so that none of them could escape the massacre.
Well, I just want to, I mean, what this makes me think of is, you know, in my true believing days, you know, being a returned missionary, being filled with, you know, filled with my testimony and, you know, with absolute trust in my leaders, you know, seeing, you know, born in another time in another place that could have been me.
Exactly.
You know, there, and
exactly.
Thinking, I can easily see myself, you know, here I was this, you know, just innocent, trusting person. And what do you do? You know, what
exactly.
Do you do when that gun's put in your hand, you know?
So to finish his story, and then I want to get into exactly what
I thought you were finished.
About.
Sorry.
No, because I think it's important to understand how they lived after, right? And so after the massacre, he married another one of the Haight girls who bore him 12 children. In 1879, he took a second wife, entered into a plural marriage. Also, in late 1870s, he served as a missionary in Scotland. In 1896, he prepared an affidavit attempting to minimize his own role in the massacre, and he lived the remainder of his life as a day laborer doing odd jobs and died in 1914. Mm-hmm. All right. This massacre did have a profound effect on these people, but what do you do except pick up and move on, right? And probably never utter a word about it until the time of affidavits started coming around.
We're talking about this, and also to confirm the whole thing about everybody has somebody in Mountain Meadows. Nephi Johnson is one of my Johnsons, and
wait, that's one of my Johnsons too.
That's how it works. And it was his dad that wrote the words to "High on a Mountaintop." That's where they fit in Mormonism. But the stories we heard growing up, and then they're in most of the histories too, is that Nephi Johnson on his deathbed was unconscious. You know, the way people die. And reportedly, the last thing he did was he opened his eyes and screamed, "Blood, blood, blood," and promptly died. And as far as anybody knew, and aside from being a key witness at the second trial of John D. Lee, he never talked about it. That's how it came out.
Yeah, thank you. I've read that account, and that was another heartbreaker. So to me this is one of the most compelling aspects of this, because when you look at some comparative models of this, I think that you can begin to understand how people who are otherwise, like I said, hardworking, decent, believing people can turn into mass murderers in a relatively short time span. And the books that I would recommend, one book I'd recommend is called Common Men by Christopher Browning. Common Men discusses a unit of Nazi soldiers. These soldiers they didn't pass the highest tests, so they were relegated to a lower position, right? But these soldiers were told to kill X number of Jews. And they were ordinary men. They were not Nazi fanatics.
I saw this movie. Are you telling us Inglourious Bastards?
Is that fictional?
But like I said, these were ordinary middle-aged men of working class from backgrounds in Hamburg. Who had been drafted but found unfit for military duty. In some cases, these men were ordered to round up Jews, and if there was not enough room for them on the trains, to shoot them. In other more chilling cases, they were ordered to merely kill a specific number of Jews in a given town or an area. This is the interesting part. The commander of the unit gave the men a choice of opting out of this duty if they found it to be unpleasant. But the majority did not choose to exercise that option, resulting in 15 men out of a battalion of 500 who dropped out. The rest went along with the orders. Again, and Browning argues this in his book, that these men in this unit, Unit 101, killed out of a basic obedience to authority and not out of bloodlust or primal hatred. Right? So while the specifics of this book deal with killings performed by otherwise average men, the general implication of the book is applicable to Mountain Meadows Massacre, and that is that most people will adhere to a command given, even if they find that act to be morally reprehensible. And additionally, the book also demonstrated that ordinary men will likely follow orders, even those that they might personally question, when they perceive that those orders originated from a position of authority.
Well, and again, we talked about this in our Mormonism and Violence, but it's in the scriptures. Nephi chops off Laban's head because it was necessary.
The second comparative model is the Stanford Prison Experiment. Is everybody familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment? So a basic recap of that, 1971, it was a psychological study of the effects of prisoners in relationship with prison guards, right? The experiment was conducted in the basement of one of the buildings at Stanford University between August 14th and August 20th, 6 days only. That was as long as they could last because it turned into a riot, right? 24 male students had volunteered for this. They had advertised it in the newspaper, looking for students who were willing to participate in this experiment. They were not real prisoners. They knew they were not real prisoners. They were volunteering for this experiment. And out of that group, there was some that were selected randomly to be given the role of a prison guard, and some that were selected, the rest that were selected to be prisoners. These prisoners adopted to their roles far more than was expected by those who were conducting the experiment, to the point of violence, to the point of psychological trauma, and of cruelty towards each other and prisoners, and to the point of almost a mob outbreak. They had to shut the experiment down before everything got crazily out of hand. But once again, the results of this experiment have argued to demonstrate the impressionability and obedience of people when they are provided with a legitimizing ideology, right, and social and institutional support for that ideology. Relating again to Mountain Meadows Massacre, the ideology and the rhetoric that was going on during the time of this event, I mean, I hate to say it, but the Fancher Party was in the wrong bloody place at the wrong bloody time. And some historians have argued that had they arrived two weeks earlier or 2 weeks later, they might have survived. Right? It was just precisely the wrong time. The third comparison that I wanted to bring up was the Jonestown Massacre. Right? So the Jonestown Massacre was a mass suicide, but I think it's applicable to this in the sense that these people also killed their children. Right? So they didn't just drink the poison themselves, but they also injected poison into the mouths of their infants. In fact, the very first person that was witnessed to have taken the poison was a young mother with a one-year-old infant, and she filled up the syringe and popped it in her child's mouth first and then did herself. Right? Horrific. Horrific to think about how this could happen, right? And all the time during this event, which actually, up until September 11th, this was the largest mass murder of American citizens, right? This happened in South America during the encampment that they had set up for themselves in a rejection of capitalism and trying to set up this commune. But the rhetoric that Jim Jones was giving was that the government was coming for your children. That the government was going to swoop in on planes, that they were going to take your children, that they were going to raise them to be fascist capitalists, that they were going to dumb them down, and that you would be powerless to this. And it would be better off if you died than to let the government do this. Right? Up to the day, and they'd actually had drills of what they would do if the government invaded, and that they would kill themselves and everybody. They called it a suicidal revolution. Right? They were going to make a statement. Right? And so right up to the very day, Jim Jones is giving this rhetoric, and they do see a plane fly overhead, and mass hysteria ensues. Jim Jones says, somebody on that plane is going to shoot the pilot, the plane is going to crash, is going to come down into the jungle, we're going to get paratroopers that parachute off of the plane, and they're going to come and take your children, and they're going to attack us, and they're going to shut us all down. Kill yourself. All right? And they do. They follow his orders and do it. I personally cannot imagine being a parent. As I am, I cannot imagine putting a syringe to my child's mouth with poison in it. But these people did. And I can't imagine that these people were much different than the people in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, than the people that were involved in the Nazi movements, or than the people that were involved in the Stanford Prison Experiment. Normal
fear,
people.
Authority, and obedience.
Yeah. Yeah.
A good concoction. And I will say we're not away from that, not to say that our leaders are anywhere near this sort of fanaticism, but obedience is a huge part of our doctrine and our rhetoric today. Obedience, obedience. You had a ward member recently tell you What was the quote? The prophet speaks.
Yeah, I had mentioned, it was just this last Sunday, I teach a gospel doctrine class, and I had mentioned that in the earlier church there was more room for public display of conflicting opinions with the church leaders. And if you look at the historical record, that seems to bear out. And she had said, if your opinion is different than that, than those of the general authorities, then you need to check your opinion. They speak for the Lord. All right. So, and, you know, I have a pretty good ward, I think. I've never been confronted, and I'm an outright liberal, so, you know, they all just make fun of me from being from Seattle and being a liberal because it rains too much or whatever. But this was the first time that I had that much pushback. But you're absolutely right. And this is what scares the hell out of me. And this is why I agreed to do this panel, why I agreed to look at this situation and the circumstances that led up to it. Because like Richard said, this could have been me. This could have been any of us, right? Given the absolutely fanatical circumstances that were going on, the fear, the drilling over and over again that the U.S. government was coming here, we need to prepare, that outsiders are here to harm us, right? I don't know how I would have responded. I would like to be brave and say, no, I would have gotten out of there as quick as possible, right?
No, I think, you know, one thing that comes to mind is I hear so many, you know, people say, I have a bumper sticker. It's not on my car because I don't put bumper stickers on my car. But I'm kind of famous for it, which just says question authority. I love that. I question authority. And it's something that's so contrary to, you know, to our teachings, you know, as we're taught as Mormons. But I just think, you know, that's what Mountain Meadows Massacre is to me. If there's a lesson for church members to glean from it, you know, present day church members, it's question authority. You know, every time authority speaks, question it, because, you know, you might not be asked to put a gun to somebody's head, but you're being asked to go out and proselytize against, you know, same-sex marriage. You're being asked, you know, you're being asked all kinds of things to do. And I know I was, you know, I was one of those Mormons that had so much faith that I always figured, well, the leaders have more experience than I do, they have more knowledge than I do, you know, they're closer to God than I am. Then I'm just, you know, I'll have faith, you know, faith in them rather than looking into myself. And that's a dangerous, dangerous place to be.
And when you look into yourself, it's a frightening thing to realize that we're capable of darkness like we never imagined.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's easy for us to suppose that we're not, but I'm sure that's what John D. Lee said, you know.
And again, I know I've been guilty of this. We've all done things in the name of God that probably haven't been very godly things. And this is a good example for that. So sorry we ran a little long, but I think that was really important. And I hope everyone rethinks the concept of obedience a little bit. I always think of it as sort of a, since my ancestor was complicit in it and the Levitt family, I would argue, could have benefited from this. I feel a sort of like a penance is to always question things now. It's almost a sacrament to me to question these things. So anyway, we'll go ahead and end with that. And we thank everyone for coming out. Thank you guys so much for being on this panel and coming out. And thank you guys for coming.
Mormon Expression is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find more about our current initiatives. Mormon Expression is recorded live in downtown Salt Lake on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. If you're in the area, please come join us in the studio.